Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup of local news from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the Federal Election Commission says that campaign contributions to Representative Mia Love, more than $1 million worth, might not have been raised legally. Also, the sensitive lands near to Canyonlands National Park, available for leasing as part of the largest BLM auction since the Bush administration. Plus, the drought gripping Utah. And later in the show, the risk of foodborne illness when you dine out. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson. Lee, it's always a pleasure.
Good morning.
Good morning. Brian Maffley, public lands reporter. The same goes for you.
Hi, Roger. How's it going?
Pretty good, thank you. And news columnist Robert Gerke. I'm kidding. Thanks. It's good to have you here as well, Robert.
It's kind of nice to be here.
Thank you. Good morning. Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the stories that we're covering, you can call us up. We are at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at our website, at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Lee, the Mia Love campaign is giving back donations, some donations anyway, and that's an unusual thing for a political campaign to be doing. Why is Representative Love returning political contributions?
Well, what's more unusual is the FEC says she may have violated campaign rules because she raised money for a primary that she knew she would never face. You can't do that. In Utah, there's a possibility of facing three elections, the convention, the primary, and the general. And donors face limits for each election. As an individual, you can give $2,700 for each election. So, gee, it would be nice if an individual donor could give you that limit three times instead of two. FEC in a letter told her, you're not participating in the 28 primary, so give all that primary money back. Her campaign is disputing that they did anything wrong. They're saying, in 2016, you FEC let Senator Mike Lee keep money similarly, and we're just doing what he did. They are giving back $370,000 that she raised after the convention, and she clearly was the nominee. No one else was running against her. Others say, she knew she didn't have any opposition since at least March 15th, which is the filing deadline. No one ever filed against her.
Is it how much money she raised after March 15th that is the problem, or is it that she was designating certain donations for that specific primary battle that wasn't
the whole primary battle is a problem?
Okay.
She's claiming it's not. She's claiming that in the past, FEC allowed people like Mike Lee to do this.
Which they did, right?
Okay. But they also made clear that it was for that race only.
Okay.
So she's giving back some money, but not all of it. Her opponent, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams, is saying, this shows a culture of corruption by Mia Love, and she ought to be giving all of the money back. There's another thing going on here. For the FEC to formally rule against her, it takes a majority of the six-member commission. However, there are two vacant seats, so all four current members would have to vote unanimously to say, you broke the rules, you must refund this. And some people think that the Love campaign knows that and kind of banking on the fact that it would be hard for a majority to rule that way. In short, they're arguing that she got a lot of extra money from people who had capped out on how much they could give her by seeking money for this primary that wasn't going to happen.
News columnist Robert Gerke, how do you view this? Is it, trying to bend the rules? Is it a good faith mistake?
No, I mean, it's not bending the rules. It's breaking the rules as Lee mentioned, this has happened before where people that don't have a primary contest are raising money for a primary contest, but certainly not to this extent. And for her to kind of try to argue that she's going to keep, I think she's keeping $300,000 of it, or she's returning
like $700,000.
She's keeping $700,000, returning $300,000. That's $700,000 that no other candidate gets to raise. Lee made the point as well that the FEC typically is a toothless tiger. They don't really They it takes them a long time to rule on these things. The vacancies make it difficult for them to proceed on this one. So she's going to push this as far as she can. But I think politically, I think this kind of hurts her because, you know, this is, as we have seen, it appears to be a pretty close race. And I think this looks bad for her. This kind of dominated the news cycle for a day or two. And you know, I think it is a nice, easy target for the McAdams campaign to swing at.
Did you know, actually, Robert said something that I want to just fact check with you, Lee. Did Ben McAdams, you know, he also did not face a primary challenger. Was he raising money this way as well?
He did not. He raised money for the convention and then for the general. And he says, gee, we knew what the law was and we didn't break it. And he did face some opposition in the convention and eliminated it there early.
And it's not hard for the candidates to know that if they're going to have two elections or three, if they're going to have a convention primary or in general, or if they're just going to have a convention in general. So, you know, it's pretty straightforward. And the campaign, the people who run her campaign are not new at this. They should know, or they should have known when they were raising money, that they couldn't raise money for an election they weren't having. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole point of having caps.
You know, the adage is that money wins elections, you know, that if you have a lot of money in the banks, that's how you're gonna run a campaign. You're gonna have a lot of advertising, and that makes the concept of representational democracy maybe feel a little farcical. But if I don't have any money to give, you know, I have my one vote, but that's all I've got. Mm-hmm. The person with $1 million to give, they can kind of control outcomes a little bit. I guess what I'm saying with all of this is that the pressure to fundraise has got to be immense, and you know, especially if you want to win, what does that say? What does all of this say about how this process works, Gerke?
Well, I mean, the Love campaign has raised a tremendous amount of money. Both campaigns are raising a lot of money on this election because it's going to be a close race, and the House could be in the balance, you know, with every race around the country. I think she's burning through a lot of money. I think she needs the money. She just went up with her first TV buy, which I think we're going to talk about here shortly. Yeah. But, you know, that costs money. And so she doesn't want to be turning money back when deplete her bank account going into this is not the time where you want to be out trying to raise money to get you through to November. You want to have money in the bank that you can run the campaign on through the next couple months. And there is an immense amount of pressure on these campaigns to make sure that they're bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars for the duration of the campaign. And so it would be a big blow to the campaign to have to turn more of this money back than the $300,000 they're talking about.
And you talked about, the $300,000, and they're trying to hold on to that $700,000. Did you know, you talked about the sort of political repercussions, that it looks bad, but does this resonate with voters, or is this something that they are paying attention to, or you know, I've seen arguments out there that it doesn't really matter from a voter's perspective.
You know, I think there are probably, you know, the Mia Love supporters will probably, you know, say this is, you know, fake news or whatever, and that this is much ado about nothing. The McAdams supporters are going to, you know, act like it's the end of the world, and you know, she should be in jail. This election always is going to be decided by those people in the middle, and I think this might resonate with some of those swing voters, the unaffiliated voters in the middle, who are legitimately on the fence. I mean, it doesn't look good to be bending the rules and then trying to, you know, willfully disobey the rules at the end, you know, and keep as much money as you can. And it also, like you were referring to, kind of goes to the issue of money in politics, and is it okay that our political system is driven so heavily by campaign donations from lobbyists and special interests?
It's a question that maybe voters are asking themselves as well. But all's fair in love and war. This campaign kind of feels like war, Lee Davidson, more so now because of an attack ad that the Mia Love campaign launched against McAdams. Robert Gerke mentioned it. What is this ad all about? What is it? How does it portray McAdams?
Well, it tries to portray Adams as not a moderate, but a big spender and kind of a liberal when it comes to spending. He's been using a school bus that he drives around the district on, and the ad shows people on the Ben bus. But they're told about how he hired a lot of aides at a big salary and how he, you know, supports tax increases. And so it shows them on a bumpy ride, and they all try to hop off because he's this liberal. Hmm. McAdams used the controversy over Love's fundraising, saying, gee, this is paid with illegal campaign donations. And they say it's dishonest. And they put out a point-by-point rebuttal to a lot of the claims in the end.
And they also pointed to the story we were just talking about, the FEC questions about fundraising.
Right. Again, they're trying to claim that they brought it up again, saying, gee, we bet this is paid with illegal campaign donations and just don't trust anything Love says.
Robert Gehrke, is this, is going negative kind of an inevitability for this campaign, the fact that it is as competitive as it is?
I mean, I think we knew we were going to end up there. I was a little surprised that we got there this early, I think. You know, and especially for a candidate who proclaims to be leading in the race by a comfortable margin, to go negative first is sort of unusual. But, you know, they've been storing up this ammunition. Both campaigns have been storing up a lot of ammunition for months, and they're going to start lobbing these bombs back and forth. This wasn't a particularly hard hit, I don't think. I mean, it does focus on his record, and you know, that's obviously fair game in a political campaign. And it's couched in a negative manner, but I think if voters were taken aback by this, they're gonna have a long couple months, because it's gonna get pretty nasty before it's over.
Some comments from people paying attention to this story on the Tribune's Twitter feed. About behind the headlines here, John Clark tweets, the bus commercials are disgusting, shameful, tasteless, and Trumpian. I'm wondering if Trump plays a role in this election. Is Trump a factor in this particular race?
I think to some degree he will be. I think it's, McAdams is going to probably point to the fact that Mia Love votes with Donald Trump about 92% of the time, according to the 538 analysis. That's an easy target for him, I think, because, you know, if you look at the 4th district in particular and the state generally, Trump is not particularly popular. His approval rating is down around 45% statewide, but it's going to be lower in the 4th district, and it's going to be even lower again among those sort of those moderate swing voters, the ones that, again, like I said, decide this election. So I think he will be a target in that sense. I also think that there nationwide, what we've seen is Republicans are sort of unenthused right now. Nationwide, the Democrats are leading on a generic ballot by about 8 points. And so it's depressing the Republican voter enthusiasm and voter turnout. We've seen that in other elections around the state. And if that happens here in the 4th, it could be a pivotal factor. The flip side of that, obviously, is you've got Mitt Romney on the ballot, too. And so when Mia Love released an internal poll this week, one of the things she talked about is, yes, there will be somewhat of a blue wave, but that could be offset by Mitt Romney driving Republican voters and Republican voters excited to go out and actually vote for him to be the next senator. So maybe it balances out. There's a lot of moving pieces in this field.
Lee, how about polling? There have been polls with kind of complicated results, one showing Love ahead by as much as 10 points or close to 10 points, another showing a much tighter race. What are these two polls?
Well, there's a lot of polls out, and it depends who's doing them. Not surprisingly, polls by Mia Love show her up by bigger margins. McAdams had one claiming that he was within 2 points. Most outside polls show around 6 points. One by the Utah Debate Commission had Love up more, I think around 11 points. It shows maybe it's early and people are all over the place. Also, it shows that maybe campaigns themselves often put out polls that help their fundraising, frankly. It's something they can pass around Washington, D.C. saying, see, I'm close, or, you know, I need your money.
Yeah,
there may be some of that going on.
Well, just a couple of months now until Election Day. Lee Davidson, we're going to circle back around to you a little bit later in the show. But for now, we are going to take our first break. A pledge break, in fact. But when we come back, we will turn to drought in the state of Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah, not Access Utah. I'm an Access Utah chair here, but Behind the Headlines. I love this program, Denny. Danny Hayes is with me, and I'm so glad we have it on Friday mornings.
I know. I look forward to it every single Friday. and, you know, it's the news roundup of the whole week. You got the Salt Lake Tribune reporters in there talking with Roger McDonough, and they just do a fabulous job of going over so much in an hour. And I don't know how they do it. And I think, you know, the theme of our pledge drive this this fall is Stand with the Facts. And I think this show is a perfect example of
perfect example. So we so appreciate the partnership with KCBW here and the good folks, Roger McDonough, who hosts the show, and the Tribune by extension. And this fund drive, and indeed public radio, is all about partnerships. We partner with various organizations, and we partner with you. It's a community. And you really make this run with your pledge in whatever amount. No pledge too small or too large.
Definitely not.
Here's the place to go, 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. We just have a brief moment here, another 30 seconds to get you to the phone. But if this is your program, take advantage of the time while you're thinking about it and call now.
Yeah, 800-826-1495. You can also go online, upr.org, and collect your mug, Stand with the Fact mug. It's at the $96 level.
Stand with the Facts, $96, and it's Aggie Blue, essentially.
It's a nice...
The UPR on one side, NPR, with Stand with the Facts, and NPR on the other side. So important these days. We certainly emphasize this, NPR does, and so does the Tribune. Partnerships here, and the most important part of that partnership is you. 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or you can go online to upr.org, upr.org. It's Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. I could hear them faintly.
We're back on Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics reporter Lee Davidson, public lands reporter Brian Maffley, and columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments. 801-355-8255 is the number to call to join this show. Or you can post them at the KCPW Facebook page or sltrib.com. Brian Maffley, let's turn now to the drought that we are experiencing here in Utah. And actually, before we go there, I have a question for you. Is Utah experiencing a drought, or is it that our expectations of rainfall and snowfall have always been inflated?
Yeah. Well, this summer's been undoubtedly dry. But it could be that we're entering a new kind of climate. We know that climate change is happening. This has been a particularly warm and dry summer, and what's interesting about it is we haven't had a lot of record highs. We've had a lot of record high lows. In other words, the minimum temperatures have been on the high end. So it has been a very warm summer, and obviously very little rain, especially up here in the northern end of the state. And so this week, the governor's office, or the Department of Natural Resources, convened this special meeting to kind of assess the situation. I was in the room with all these department heads from federal agencies as well. And what came out of that meeting wasn't a list of prescriptions, but just a list of, wow, here are the hardships we're facing. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that there might be some proposals, being floated around how to deal with it, but there weren't. But there were a lot of unexpected impacts that were articulated at this meeting. Would you want me to go through some of them?
Absolutely. Yeah. I know that stream flows, livestock or wildlife being threatened by this.
Livestock and wildlife. But the stream flow thing. Yeah, okay. That's something everyone would expect. But that. All these fawn and calf, elk and baby elk and baby deer, they're dying at alarming numbers. But in spite of that, the Division of Wildlife Resources decided to increase the number of deer that could be harvested this year under the rationale that there's too many, the range can't, and forage available cannot support our deer herds. So we need to reduce those numbers, even though the fawns are dying. Some of that was kind of counterintuitive. The other part of this was obviously agriculture is going to suffer. Water deliveries are being cut way back. A lot of farmers aren't going to be able to harvest nearly as much alfalfa as they usually do. What's that do to the price of alfalfa? It goes through the roof. the ranchers now have to rely on that alfalfa because the forage on the range is depleted, but they can't afford the alfalfa because it's so expensive. So they're selling off their herds, getting not nearly as much money as they would like. And that's causing a lot of hardship out there. So I think we've six counties so far, probably as of last Monday, had declared drought emergencies. Maybe more are on the way, but clearly farmers and ranchers are hurting.
Governor Gary Herbert is kind of receiving all of this information, and he can make a declaration of sorts on this, Brian. What would that be, and what would that do?
Well, it'll be down the road. It's not clear. You know, we also know that the levels of water in our reservoirs, especially Lake Powell, are really low in the southern part of the state. What does that mean next year? Well, you know, if we go into another dry winter and these reservoirs don't get replenished, there will be a lot of water shortages. And I thought at some point we're going to be talking about, you know, water rationing like they do in California. We're not there yet, probably because we just don't have the huge urban areas that they do in California. But I think it's going to be something that we might have to think about. We are apparently we're kind of stuck in a weather pattern right now that is deflecting moist weather elsewhere.
You quoted I'm going to jump in on that because you quoted Brian McInerney, a hydrologist with the National Weather Service, in your article, and he very directly pointed to man-made climate change as a serious factor in this problem.
Yeah, he was the only one to do that. And what he was saying was, look, there's not a lot of progress is being made on limiting carbon emissions, so we're going to have to just learn how to live with this this situation, which means adapting to less water being available.
The science shows that warming, you know, the warming that is happening is going to continue to happen, whether or not we take immediate and drastic actions. The American West in serious peril, Brian Mathley? Maybe that's a question for Robert Gerke, but I mean, it...
Well, it seems like that requires a crystal ball.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, weather patterns could change for reasons that are hard to understand. I feel uncomfortable, you know, blaming all these catastrophes on man-made climate change. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, of course, we're having a horrible fire season this year. How much of that is climate change? How much of that is past forest management practices? I think it's a lot of people on both sides of the climate change debate are pointing the fingers in ways that are convenient for them. But I think I don't know if the science has proven that climate change is the reason why we're having all these forest fires, but there seems to be a good circumstantial case.
Right.
We've got a lot of tinderbox conditions out there from the dry, warm summer, and things are going off. And we've got, you know, we saw this fire down by the Nebo Loop go from 400 acres to 20,000 acres in a day or two. The conditions are extreme.
Yeah. Robert Gerke, the comments on the arid West, also on the contribution of climate change, at least, to the drying out of the West.
Well, I think, I spoke with a state climatologist recently, and he pointed out that his own research, that the temperatures in Utah have increased more dramatically than in other states. And if you look ahead to where we're going, we're going to see they're projecting less snow at the sort of the base of the ski resorts, you know, about 7,000 feet. We're going to start seeing those snow levels creep up. That means there's less water kept in that snowpack to come down and fill up these reservoirs like Brian's talking about. There's no indication that the trajectory that we've been on is going to turn around anytime soon, and so we do have to start thinking about these issues that they're talking about. On, you know, the governor put out a 10-year, I believe, water plan, but there are real problems with this in a state where they don't want to have a heavy hand and try to influence the way people use water. it's an incredibly scarce resource. And at some point, the state's going to have to step in and start saying, you know, we need to take more drastic steps. Asking people to conserve is fine, but you know, we're up against a pretty serious wall that we're zooming toward. And the ranchers, not only are they being hurt by this drought, but they're being hurt by these tariffs too, because you know the yields are down, and it's really hard for them to sell their crops, and they're getting crowded out by other crops that are backing up because they can't be sold overseas because of these tariffs. And so they're in a real dire circumstance this year. I think as early as June, San Pete County was already starting to cut back on its water deliveries. And so, you know, if this is not climate change and it's the new normal, then we've got to prepare for this for the next, you know, for the foreseeable future. And it's going to take some decisive, I guess, action by the state to make sure that we're taken care of water-wise for the coming years.
Brian, there's a story that you reported on that's kind of related to this. You reported this week, actually, and it's a drought story. Maybe. It's a drought year, a bad drought year, and Emigration Creek, this historic waterway in Utah, has been dry through a few months and earlier than usual. Whether drought is the culprit here, though, kind of depends upon who you ask. Can you explain?
That's a really interesting story. Yeah. Emigration Creek is the creek that flows through Emigration Canyon into Salt Lake City, and it's also where the most expensive residential real estate in Salt Lake County is as well. And maybe 600 homes are up there, and there's a lot of groundwater pumping to provide water to those homes. And there's quite a conflict in that canyon between the residents of the older homes along the canyon bottom and the newer subdivisions up in the hills where the water pumping is occurring. The folks along the river feel that water pumping is what's responsible for the creek going dry as much as the drought. So the drought is exacerbating a situation that's made worse by the groundwater pumping. It's worth noting that Immigration Creek is hardly the only creek in Utah that's gone dry. So at that drought meeting, a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey talked about the 154 streams that they monitor around the state, and 12 of those streams have set, you know, all-time lows, flows never before recorded. And then in a lot of them, they have to go to their stream flow monitoring equipment and reposition it in the stream channel because it's not in the water anymore because the water's so low. And, you know, it's pretty alarming stuff. And then when you look at that, you're going, well, what's going on in Immigration Creek is going on all over the state. So, it seems maybe you're getting ahead of yourself to blame the groundwater pumping.
Who's doing the groundwater pumping, though? I mean, it's the developers who are building the houses?
Yeah.
Or?
No, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago, Immigration Improvement District formed to provide services to the residents of Immigration Canyon. And in the years since, it's now become a township. But it's this special district is who's doing the pumping.
They have the water right essentially to do this?
Yeah, they acquired lots of water rights back in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. What's interesting about their main water right is, which accounts for much of their water, is it's a very old one that dates to 1872 for surface water down at the mouth of the canyon. And it was a water right that fed a historic orchard and ranch. It's obviously long gone.
Right.
And so the district has, since the late 80s, have filed what's called a change application to change the terms of that water right so they can pull the water from the ground way up canyon. Their opponents are arguing, well, you know, you need to go get a permanent change application. And hey, while you're at it, you're losing your priority, that 1872 priority, which would make it one of the oldest water rights there. that's a battle that's being fought before the state engineer. So it's up for that office to sort through that one. So a lot's at stake.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. The question that I guess is at the heart of it is there enough water in the canyon to support the amount of development that has happened?
I think the answer is pretty much no. I mean, when you've got a creek that no longer has water in it, and it's hard to argue that you can continue developing up there.
Yeah. Robert Gerke, if it is that the watershed is being depleted because of too much development, I asked this question earlier about the arid West being doomed. How do we prevent development, or how, should we be thinking about preventing development in places where we don't have the resources to have that happen, where it doesn't make sense to do it?
Well, and that gets incredibly prickly too, because because we're a state where our legislature believes fervently in private property rights. If you own the property, you can develop it. So we've seen this. We've seen similar fights up Big Cottonwood Canyon with the landowners up there who want to, build cabins or develop, in some cases, larger developments. And they're fighting with Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County over water rights there as well. This is going to be a recurring theme, I think. And again, it kind of part of it goes back to this creeping snow level. We don't have the snowpack that we've had in past years, and we're not going to have the snowpack in the coming years. It appears. And so this is a fight that's going to continue, and we're going to see it fought in other parts of the state as well, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, an ongoing story, obviously, and Brian Maffley, public lands reporter, thank you very much for covering it. Yep. We need to take another quick break here on the show, a slightly longer pledge break, as a matter of fact. And when we come back to it, the sensitive areas that are on the auction block in and around Canyonlands National Park, we'll also circle back to some politics, a poll showing a tightening race in Utah's 2nd congressional district. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio's Behind the Headlines. Tom Williams with Danny Hayes. A great program, one of my favorites. I think a favorite of all the staff here. Mm-hmm. That's a somewhat recent addition to our lineup, a partnership with KCPW. Great folks over there. Roger McDonough has of course, a round table of Salt Lake Tribune reporters. All of the news here highlights something very important that we're pushing during this fund drive, which is get registered to vote.
Get registered to vote. And does our listeners know you can come to the station and get registered to vote if you want?
You can come right to the station.
Yeah. And you can get some Cafe Ibis coffee, get a treat, and register to vote.
So encourage you to do that. Of course, if you're in the Cache Valley area within an easy drive of, we wouldn't expect you to drive from Moab up here to register to vote. Although, we'd love to see you and we'll give you a tour of the station, whatever, if you'd like to do that. But come, take care of your pledge if you'd like. And we have a little table, sign there, say register to vote. We've got the forms there. It's an easy process. But however you're going to vote, please do vote.
Yeah, it's important.
800-826-1495 is the way to another vote that you would do and we're encouraging you to do is a vote yes. I approve of Utah Public Radio. I want to be part of the community. And I want to support Behind the Headlines. It's a fast and easy call, 800-826-1495.
Yeah, what a perfect time to call if you do feel passionate about politics and getting people educated to vote. I know I love Behind the Headlines because it's a wrap-up. It gives me so much information in a short amount of time. It's a perfect partnership with KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. And so if you appreciate it, too, give us a call, 800-826-1495, or go to upr.org.
800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or upr.org. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. Again, I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup. Call us with your questions or comments, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Brian Maffley, periodically there are oil and gas lease auctions that happen on federal lands in Utah. And, before we get to the sort of newsier part of this, maybe you can just remind us why these auctions happen and how they are conducted.
Well, first I wanted to ask you, Roger, if you had, $3,000 laying around. Because I'm going to tell you what to do with it next, okay? The Bureau of Land Management holds these auctions for the state, for Utah public lands every quarter. And we just had one earlier this week. And we have now kind of entered into the Trump era of energy dominance, where the Interior Department will offer land for lease very quickly, with at not nearly as much environmental review as was occurring during the Obama years. So the energy dominance agenda now is in play, and the last auction was a very big one, the biggest one since the George W. Bush administration. It was 200,000 acres were available for auction. The next quarterly auction, more than 300,000 acres will be made available. But what was interesting about this auction was, over a third of the parcels that were made available didn't even get the minimum bid. Another third got the minimum, sold for the minimum bid, which is $2 an acre. Hmm. And so it kind of tells me, well, industry doesn't really seem all that eager to acquire these lands. We already have a million acres of public land under lease in Utah that hasn't been developed. It's a lot of people are wondering, well, why is the BLM now pushing all this acreage out the door when industry doesn't seem all that interested?
How long can industry sit on it, though? I mean, can they? It's a yearly lease, or how long does the how long do the leases go for?
They're good for 10 years. However, the BLM routinely grants suspensions on those leases to give the developers additional time to start developing. But you're supposed to start developing within 10 year, producing, that is, within 10 years, and then you're supposed to pay rents of $1.50 an acre.
I mentioned at the outset the sensitive lands around Canyonlands National Park that were included at least in this in this auction. What happened with them?
Yeah, well, this is where your $3,000 investment comes in, Roger. There was a huge block of land that the BLM put out there. It's called the San Rafael Desert. It is the area kind of east of Hanksville all the way to the border of Canyonlands National Park at the Horseshoe Canyon Unit, which is a non-contiguous part of the park. So this big block of land goes on auction. Most of it sells for either $2 an acre or doesn't even get the minimum bid. And I think it was those lands that really unnerved the environmental community, because they had their wilderness quality, they're very close to a national park, and there didn't seem to be any pressing need to make them available for oil and gas leases. So when the BLM sells a lease, it has committed those resources for at least 10 years for oil and gas development. So what's happened is what's interesting about all that acreage that didn't sell at the auction on Tuesday, well, you after we get off the radio show here, you and I can go down to the BLM office and buy some of these parcels, leases on these parcels for $1.50 an acre. So right next to the Horseshoe Canyon unit of the National Park, there's a 2,000 acre parcel that did not sell.
I think we'll get into some trouble if we do that, Brian. I believe that someone tried to do a sort of protest bid in the past and ran into some problems. Yeah. Yeah. Brian, I'm going to refer people to your story, because it turns out that we actually have to turn already to our underplayed stories of the week, thanks to a final segment in this show. But they can find your reporting on this at sltrib.com. And my apologies for cutting you short on this.
Sure.
But check out Brian Maffley's reporting on this. Guys, quick take on underplayed stories of the week before we head to Kathy Stevenson talking about the risk of dining out. Who wants to start? Robert Gerke?
Yeah. Taylor Stevens did a story this week about Michael Jensen, who was the former Unified Fire Authority chief, and was accused of some malfeasance, some misused credit cards, that sort of thing. Both he and his deputy chief were fired, and it was announced this week there's not going to be any criminal charges against him. Side note, he also still is representing the county on this Inland Port Authority Board, which is, maybe not the best person to be there, but
something to check out. Thank you for that. Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, your pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, another story by Taylor. Some very prominent Park City folks were arrested on charges of taking hunting equipment out of the woods. And I'm calling this story out not because it's a horrific crime. It really isn't. But what I think it speaks to is the growing tension we're seeing on public lands near where people live, between hunters and non-hunters. What I think may have motivated these folks was this feeling that the lands near their home at Summit Park is not an appropriate place for hunting, and maybe took the law into their own hands.
Okay. Yeah. We'll check out Taylor Stevens' story on that at sltrip.com. Lee Davidson, quickly, your underplayed story of the week.
New U.S. Census data out this week shows that West Valley City is the first large city in Utah where whites no longer are the majority. Minorities overall make up the new majority there.
Majority.
I happen to live in West Valley City, and my cul-de-sac might be an example of that. Huh. On my little cul-de-sac, I have 5 Latino neighbors. I have some neighbors who are Somalian refugees, another neighbor from Thailand, and the rest of us are white people.
Wow. So. Interesting. Minority majority there in West Valley City. Thanks, you guys, for joining me here for Behind the Headlines. I'm going to forego my underplayed story of the week, but again, thank you, all of you.
Thank you.
We're going to finish up today with Kathy Stevenson, who spoke with KCPW producer Emily Means about health code violations and foodborne illness outbreaks at restaurants.
Kathy Stevenson, Tribune reporter. Not only do you get to write about delicious food news, like a new restaurant opening or food truck face-offs or, you know, adding another local brewery to the lineup, but you also cover restaurants that have been, you know, closed down or cited over health code violations and foodborne illness outbreaks. So in that vein of things, I wish we were talking about new breweries, but why don't you tell us what happened with the New Yorker restaurant this week?
I get to cover the good, the bad, and the ugly with restaurants. Mm-hmm. And this obviously was not good news for many people who love the New Yorker. The New Yorker, there was an employee who had contracted hepatitis A and had worked for several weeks from July 15th through August and had possibly infected up to 650 people who had come through the restaurant. And so the health department issued a press release kind of letting the public know that if you have eaten at the restaurant during this time period, you should be watching for signs. There is a vaccination that can kind of help you prevent some of the symptoms. But at that point, it was too late for them to get the vaccination.
Right.
So they basically just have to keep watch and contact their healthcare provider or contact the health department if they see the symptoms. So the New Yorker is still open. It hasn't necessarily closed. I think it probably closed when they found out the employee had been infected, and they went through and cleaned the kitchen. I'm sure they did that on a day it was closed. And the health department says it's safe and it's fine. But, you know, no restaurant wants to have that happen.
Right. And, you know, not that any restaurant is safe from this sort of thing, but it's considered an upscale restaurant and maybe a little surprising to some of the guests.
Exactly. And the owners and the chef had offered hepatitis A vaccinations to all the employees, and this particular person did not take advantage of that. And it kind of makes you wonder, like, why aren't, you know, restaurants making it mandatory? You have to have a food handler's permit, you have to have a Hep A, you know, vaccination, right?
Hand in hand.
Like, it almost seems like you should make it mandatory. The Salt Lake County Health Department hasn't made that mandatory for working. You know, you have to have a food handler's permit. Mm-hmm. But just because the outbreak has been going, it started in California, you know, and it's been going, and we know it's around Salt Lake County. I don't know. An ounce of prevention is good.
It's a good measure to take, perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, you've reported on a number of restaurants being cited due to health code violations, and I noticed a lot in this past year. What are the most common offenses?
You know, really, overall cleanliness is what the inspectors are looking for when they go into the restaurants. And they're not restaurants get inspected. They know they're going to be inspected, but it's kind of surprise visits. Mm-hmm. So,
like a secret shopper kind of thing?
It's a little bit like a secret shopper. And depending on how critical your restaurant is, like an ice cream shop isn't going to get visited by the inspectors as much as one that's handling raw meat and fish and all that. So you know you're going to have an inspection. So when the inspectors come in, they're just looking for overall cleanliness. Are you keeping things clean? Are you keeping the meat separate from the vegetables? When you store something, are you labeling it so you know what day it went in the fridge? You know, like at home when you have your leftovers, mm-hmm. like, oh, how old is this? You know, in a restaurant, you want them to know. Like,
so you can't just do the smell test? No. Is that what you're saying?
No. You know, and the ones I write about are really the extreme. They're the ones that are closed. I mean, every day, county health inspectors are going to restaurants looking for things. And, you know, I would say probably 80 to 85% of all restaurants pass. Or if they have violations, they can fix them quickly and they're not closed. Mm-hmm. So the ones that we write about in the Tribune are the ones that are the extreme. So I hope people recognize that. You know, they're the ones that have mice or cockroaches or, you know, they're uncleanly. You know, a big thing that places get shut down for, no hot water. You have to be able to wash your dishes and sanitize them. And if there's no hot water, can't wash your hands. If the employees aren't able to wash their hands.
Is that a big surprise? I mean, you would kind of imagine that most facilities have access to hot water, right?
And I think a lot of times it's, I think it's a couple things. Sometimes the owner is not there and it's left to a manager. And mm-hmm. if he or she is not paying attention that the water is not hot, you know, whereas maybe if an owner was there, maybe they're a little bit more diligent than just somebody they've hired. And, mm-hmm. you know, I do sometimes think, because a lot of the ones that are closed are ethnic restaurants, so I do think there is a little language barrier or just sure. or just an understanding of, you know, what the health laws in America or Utah are compared to other cultures. Because if you know, if you've traveled abroad,
yeah.
you know, everybody has different kind of views of what needs to be done. And right. so not wrong or right, just different than when you come to America and there are, you know, strict guidelines. Right. So, and sometimes a language barrier, maybe the health department's trying to work with them and maybe, you know, language is a difficulty.
Sure. You know, you were saying that the county goes in and makes these inspections. Are the standards different from county to county?
I don't think they're much different. Okay. I mean, I know each county has their own health department and each county does the restaurant inspections. Salt Lake County is probably the best at making their information available to the public. You can just go on their website, click on inspections, and you can plug in any restaurant name and city, and you can see their inspection reports. Weber County does this also. It's not quite as easy to navigate, I don't think. And I believe Davis and Summit counties also do that too. Okay. Utah County, possibly. I think it's kind of the larger metropolitan mm-hmm. areas. I think the standards are the same. They're all looking for cleanliness. They're all looking to prevent contamination and bacterial growth. I see a lot of things on those inspection reports where restaurants aren't keeping the food either really cold or really hot. It's that middle ground between right. like 40 and 75, the danger zone, where bacteria can grow. And, you know, when they're not doing that, that's when trouble happens. So that's universal. That's, you know, every county's looking for that, yeah. you know. So,
well, what do health departments advise restaurants and diners to do when these different cases crop up?
Well, if you feel like you have eaten something at a restaurant and you've gotten sick, you should report it. I think a lot of people don't, and I think the health department could maybe benefit if more people, you know, called and said, hey, I ate here and I'm sick. Because if four or five people are calling in at the same time within the same day saying they ate at this restaurant, then hey, that's a big red flag. Mm-hmm. So, you know, calling in, I think if you see a restaurant that you don't think is clean, I think you can call the health department and say, hey, I just ate, you know, at restaurant XYZ, and I think it needs an inspection. And so, I think that the health department would appreciate consumers calling in and letting them know what they see.
It's a little more proactive rather than responding,
reactive. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of KCPW's employees said that when he lived in California, you know, many cities had adopted this restaurant grading system, and that's where restaurants will be scored out of 100 points based on food handling practices and facility maintenance, and the results from the most recent inspection are posted in the window You can get an A, B, or a C grade, or if you get less than a C, then the number score is in the window. And I'm just wondering if we have anything like that in Utah, you know, where people are aware of the potential risks going in.
I think that that would have to be a statewide thing. I mean, maybe Salt Lake County or individual counties could do it, but I think maybe they feel it's more punitive than helpful.
Not good for business.
Not good for business, right? So, I mean, let's take, you know, the New Yorker, for example. You know, it's a good restaurant. They have been open for many, many years. Mm-hmm. It's always been clean when I've been there, and I'm sure this one thing would make them get a lower grade. And is that fair because it was an employee, not the restaurant?
Sure.
So, I mean, I can see both sides. I think there is something to be said for keeping restaurants on their toes and letting them know, like, we're watching you. Mm-hmm. I think, you know. So, I'm a little bit torn because I think the grades are so right there in your face when you go to the restaurant. And so it makes a difference. Whereas, you know, you have to kind of work a little bit and to go to the website and look up the restaurant you might be going to and mm-hmm. see what their inspection report is.
And you might not know, you know, why this restaurant got a C. It could be, you know, something a little less icky than something else.
I suppose if our area got a little bit bigger and maybe it was becoming more of a problem and we didn't have enough, you know, inspectors, maybe it's something they might consider. But I haven't heard anything to that extent. So now it's just they post the closures and I usually write about them.
Yes, you do. Well, in lieu of that sort of system, and I know you mentioned, health departments would appreciate hearing about some of these restaurants. What kind of safety tips do you have for people in dining out?
Oh, you know, I know the rules, so I kind of watch for them. Really, one of my big things is, you know, before you eat, go to the bathroom and check it out. Make sure there's hot water and soap and paper towels, right? Because if you can't wash your hands, it's likely that the employees cannot, because that's usually the only bathroom. So I think that is a big thing. I think at the fast food restaurants, I'm always kind of annoyed. The people who are handling your food are not supposed to be handling money.
Yes. Oh, that's a thought.
So there's lots of times where I'm, kind of whisper to my husband, oh, there's a health code violation right there, you know? So kind of be watching, and it doesn't mean you're going to get sick. But it just means, hey, you've got to be, you could maybe mention it to the manager, write a letter or email and just say, hey, I noticed this happened. You know, will you make sure that doesn't happen again? Mm-hmm. I think consumers need to kind of step up and demand that because restaurants get busy. They don't have enough employees a lot of times. There's other things going on. So, you know, it's okay to be proactive, like you said, and ask people like, hey, you just touched the money and now you're touching my food. I don't want it, you know, and they know.
Yeah. Be mindful of it.
They should have gone through the food handlers class. So I don't think it's bad to be a little proactive as a consumer.
All right. Well, Kathy Stevenson from the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, always happy to be here.
And again, that was KCBW producer Emily Means in conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Kathy Stevenson. To wrap up this edition of Behind the Headlines, I want to thank once again Lee Davidson, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, who joined us earlier in the show. Didn't get a chance to thank them before. Thanks very much as well to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to the staff of Utah Public Radio in Logan, and to the show's producer, Emily Means, who you were just hearing from. And thanks as well to you for tuning in. A reminder that both stations, both KCPW and Utah Public Radio, are in our fall pledge drive. We would love to count with your support for this program. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for joining us. Tom Williams here at the end of the program. Now is a perfect time to support Behind the Headlines, this great news roundup that brings you the recap that you need to know, the news you need to know. So here is the way to support it. 800-826-1495 is the toll-free number, and we have volunteers standing by, 800-826-1495. Or you can go to upr.org. That's upr.org. And thank you.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Kane College of the Arts, hosting the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and Orchestra at Temple Square, conducted by music director Mac Wilberg, Saturday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. in the USU Danes Concert Hall. Ticket details at cca.usu.edu.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.